The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Urban Connections. I'm your host, Donna Marl Wolf, joined in studio today by Matthew Forstatter, Professor of Economics and Black Studies and Director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability, the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Don. It's great to be back.
It is great to have you here. You've been my guest down through the years here on KKFI, and every time it has been a session, you know, a brand new session, a period of enlightenment that's rare when it comes to the subject of economics.
I appreciate that.
In the media. So tell us about what's been going on with you. Over there in the econ department at UMKC and at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability.
Well, it shows how long it's been since I've been here. Mm-hmm. That about half that introduction needs to be revised.
Uh-oh.
But I mean, it the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability lost most of its funding with the economic downturn that started in, you know, let's say 2008, mm-hmm. the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. I call it a terrible recession.
Okay.
I don't see why it's what's so great about it, but
yeah.
So we kept on going kind of as a virtual center, and people still refer to it. We have our website up, but actually I am in the process of organizing a new institute.
Okay.
And it's going to be a little bit different, and the name hasn't been approved, but just to give you an idea, I had been thinking along the lines of the Interdisciplinary Institute for Peace, Education, Ooh. And Sustainable Prosperity.
I like that.
Thank you.
That's what we need.
Right. So it still has the economic peace in there, prosperity,
mm-hmm.
but it's got the environment, sustainability,
mm-hmm.
education, which, you know, the longer I'm involved in teaching and education, and my wife Gail is also involved in education, and the more convinced I am that education is one of, if not the keys to long-term social change.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the relatively short time that I have been, let's say, at UMKC, less than 15 years, so it's the first time that I've taught in a PhD program, and already I have seen students who I've supervised get their doctorate, become a professor at another university, teaching hundreds of students a year, and then sending one of their students into our doctoral program. And, you know, when I think, multiply that now by the number of students, currently I'm supervising between 10 and 15 dissertations,
mm-hmm.
and then over a 40 or 50 year career, I could see how you could really, make an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the world we live in, so often we feel impatient, and rightly so, because there's so many things that need to be changed. But you see the kinds of changes in ideas, the inspiration the students feel about making an impact on the economics discipline and in policy, and of course the Occupy and other social movements, what's going on in Greece or, you know, all over the place, the Arab Spring. It really, with the technologies now, we had almost, it's not that much of an exaggeration, to say that social media drove the overthrow of governments. So it's really, the world's changing so fast. I guess people have always said that, but I still feel realistically optimistic, hopeful, yet hopefully not idealistic.
Uh-huh. So the reality of the situation.
Right. The reality can be so overwhelming, I can understand how people can get discouraged. But you know, that's one of the things that working with young people, it keeps you young and you know, we grew up, it was Watergate. And mm-hmm. if you didn't become discouraged about politics, you know, from that, but unbelievably, it seems worse even now. Maybe, you know, the word gate has been so overused. Mm-hmm. Everything's this gate, that gate. But now it seems like it's almost accepted that politics as usual. Mm-hmm. And it's not good enough.
No, it's not good enough. It's certainly not sustainable, and it certainly does the opposite of what is needed, which is, you know, nurturing of our culture and of our nation and of our world.
Right.
Actually, time's going by so fast.
Sure.
We're gonna have to take a break, Matt, and
mm-hmm.
we're gonna come back and continue our conversation with Matt Forstatter, Dr. Matthew Forstatter, Department of Economics, University of Missouri, Kansas City. You're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Urban Connections. Stay with us. We'll be back after this message.
Support for KKFI provided by the Pitch Weekly's Taste of Kansas City, Thursday, May 22nd at the KC Live Block in the Power and Light District, featuring Gold Fork competition with 6 of KC's chefs, plus food samples from over 15 local restaurants, including Couscous Euro Kebab, Hotel Phillips, Colors Macarons, the West Side Local, Pickleman's Gourmet Cafe, and more. Taste of Kansas City benefits Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Greater Kansas City. Further details at pitch.com.
One FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, Urban Connections with your host, Donald Wolf, joined in studio today by Matt Forstatter, Professor of Economics at UMKC. Matt, there's this quote near you on their website. Did you put this there? It says, it's by John Kenneth Galbraith. Is that from? It says, in all life, one should comfort the afflicted, but verily also one should afflict the comfortable, and especially when they are comfortably contented, even happily wrong.
Mm, right, right. I think the students who who organize our website actually put that and a few others that are on throughout the website, but I could have been, you know, one that I picked out.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. So.
Our citizen scholar, Benita Morrow Martin's in the studio. She had a question mm-hmm. for you, Matt.
Yes.
Benita?
Hi. Thanks, Donna. I just wanted to ask Matt, we're talking about economics and the whole shift, and I was wanted to ask you, when do you think it occurred? When do you think it started?
Right. And
that's not what you said.
Well,
but go ahead.
No, but, you know, during the break we were talking a little bit about, so.
This paradigm shift.
Right. And Benita actually mentioned that the 1980s was the turning point, and that really is correct, because if you think back after Watergate, which we mentioned, right,
mm-hmm.
And then Jimmy Carter was president, and there were the OPEC oil shocks, and it was sort of the end of what is sometimes called the golden age of U.S. capitalism. Of course, it was not golden for everyone, but what they mean by that is that from the end of World War II until, you know, we could say either 1946 to 1973 or 1950 to 1970. In that period, there was, relatively speaking, low unemployment, low inflation, and higher economic growth.
Also, a shrinking income disparity, or?
Well, that, I think I would want to check just to make sure. There's different ways of looking at that. But generally speaking, yes, because when we go back and we look at the fall in real wages over the last 40 years, it's from the mid to late 70s, even 1980, early 1980s, what no one really saw coming. And a good example of this is I have some letters that some correspondence between my professor, Robert Heilbronner, and some politicians, and it was from the mid-late 1960s, and Robert Kennedy, I think, was in the Senate, and he was asking Heilbronner for ideas for the next. Even the fact that someone was asking Robert Heilbronner for their advice about policy tells you that it was a completely different universe than he's, you know, would be considered now, you know, extremely liberal, if not, you know, radical or whatever. There's a line where Heilbronner, writing back, says, "I have no doubt that by 1990, there will be a guaranteed minimum basic income in the United States."
That's interesting.
I mean, I have no doubt.
Nothing
no
could
doubt
be farther
that,
than the truth, though.
That, you know, the government will guarantee that by right of being a human being, no one should fall below, right? So it's like a living wage,
yes,
but for everyone, regardless of whether you're working or not. I mean, are you kidding me? So, what people did not see coming was Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher in the UK, which is the same ideology, which now we call neoliberalism, you know, that is a bit more appropriate in Europe. Neoconservatism is really a better term for it in the U.S. because, you know, it really, when they say neoliberalism, they mean liberal, like a 19th century liberal, mean free markets and as little government as possible. And people who we would used to be, we would consider the fringe of the right wing, now are respectfully interviewed on NPR when they're getting different viewpoints, not as like an extremist, but as a legitimate view.
And it seems to be taken as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, this is the correct point of view.
Oh.
It seems to be the you know, overarching attitude of some ideas that are pretty extreme. I mean, about health care, for example, and the Affordable Care Act, and, you know.
Right. I mean, well, you know, it always boggles the mind when, you know, President Obama will be called a socialist, you know, because he thinks, you know, that corporations shouldn't be able to just completely run wild over, you know, every every, you know, person and or that, you know, there should be some kind of safety net that keeps people from falling through the cracks and disappearing into a downward spiral of debt and foreclosure and unemployment and so on. The increase in inequality, I mean, I know you're all familiar, you know, with these developments, but it is just unbelievable that it has gotten to the point, you know, that it has been permitted to develop in this way. And so you had, you know, two Reagan administrations and then, you know, George H.W. And then so by the time a Democrat got back in, the Democratic Party had shifted on many issues, you know, to the right of where the center had been. Mm-hmm. And so everything just shifted to the right. And so there at one time, you know, at one time there were two recognizable alternative views on many issues. And instead, now it, for all intents and purposes, has become Republicrats and Demublicans.
Okie dokie. And that's clear as mud. So, Matt, I know for several years you authored the State of Kansas City.
State of Black Kansas City.
Document. Are you still working on that?
Well, unfortunately, 2010 was the last one that we were able to obtain funding for.
Wow.
And that was a big disappointment. I heard that some people are trying to get it up and going again. And I hope they're able to, because the very next report was going to be the one where we could use the 2010 census data. And so we had done 04, 06, 08, and then 2010. But the differences were not so, so great in some of the numbers, because we were still relying on that 2000 census data for you know, for some of it. So I really wanted to do that next one, and we really tried. We went all over, and I mean, I could not believe, because this is not a you know, a six-figure type, you know, budget we're talking about. Basically, the students are working for, you know, the experience for the most part, and just a very small stipend. And I was doing everything as a pro bono, you know, myself, you know, because I really wanted to see. So it was really just one, you know, one non-student full-time researcher, not full-time, a researcher who was dedicated to it, who was actually being paid, and this was no outrageous fee or anything. So, but in any case, we still get a lot of positive feedback about the reports, and I think, you know, it was useful to you know, have something that addressed local issues. And you know, as you are well aware, in some cases, when it comes to the economics of race, class, and gender, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Absolutely. And that report was just, you know, it was startling. It was startling, you know, the contrast and the disparity. And there was an objective black and white numbers on a page, you know, that you could refer to. And in that 2010 census data would have encompassed the 2009 fall and the 2008 debacle,
right,
and all that stuff. And
we absolutely
would have, we would have seen those issues in stark reality as well. So
right, because you know, as you're aware, when there is an economic downturn in the United States, a disproportionate burden of the falling jobs, income, wages,
wealth,
is borne by the African American community and other people of color, but specifically the African American community, you know, because of their unique historical and structural economic history in the United States.
So, can you be more descriptive of the economics of racism, in light of especially these, you know, recent rulings coming down from the Supreme Court that are saying, you know, we're not enforcing affirmative action policies anymore. We're going to leave it up to the states, universities. You know, it'll be, I guess, illegal to make your choices about students' admissions related to race. Talk about that.
Right. And
do you think there's a need for affirmative action?
Yes, I do. You know, there's a great exercise that I use more for my undergrads, and it comes out of this institute that is in the D.C. area that's headed up by a fellow named Chester Hartman, author and activist and organizer, and he has in one of his books throughout, one's called The Affirmative Action Quiz, The Immigration Quiz, The Inequality Quiz, and the way it works is that almost guaranteed a classroom of 25, 30 college students will get every single answer incorrect. And, of course, the answer that people, you know, think is correct represents kind of the popular myth or popular prevalent view. For example, you know, affirmative action laws require that every firm, hire an unqualified African American or female candidate over a white or male candidate. I mean, first of all, the idea that affirmative action laws applied to all companies, mm-hmm, right?
Okay.
Completely wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had a contract with the federal government, then you may have certain requirements. But affirmative action laws never applied to all, you know, private companies. And in fact, there were some colleges that private colleges that chose not to accept any kind of federal money for work study students or things like that, because if they did, then they would have to, you know, use some. And then the confusion about, you know, so-called quotas, right? Mm-hmm. Affirmative action laws, you know, require that, you know, X percentage of, you know, employees must be, you know, people of color or women, or are you kidding me? Or that anybody, even for those who did have to follow certain guidelines, the idea ever that a less qualified person would be hired. It was if someone were equally qualified, still not you must hire, but if someone were equally qualified and everything else was the same, then promotion of diversity could be used as a criteria, as a criterion in hiring. Otherwise, you know, normally you're not allowed to use, you know, race or gender, you know, in making a hiring decision, right? So this simply permitted that those factors to be taken into consideration if every single other thing, you know, right? So, I mean, and then, of course, the other interesting thing in Hartman's book, I'll have to share these quizzes. Maybe even you could, you know, put one up on your website or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, another is, well, we have had affirmative action for years in the United States for whites, yeah, for men. I mean, that's, you know, if you really want to get down to it. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, so it still is unbelievable to me that, I mean, even setting reparations, that, you know, and I mean, we have seen, you know, Jewish survivors of Holocaust, Native Americans, even Japanese victims of the internment during World War II, just about every other group. But, you know, for what is arguably, you know, the most horrific and brutal institutionalized discrimination and oppression in history, the enslavement followed by legal institutional racism, not only has there, you know, been no reparations, what about simply having a leader come out and acknowledge how wrong it was? How about just the simple apology? You may remember, you know, what a controversy it kicked up when, you know, I guess maybe Clinton was visiting West Africa and so on. So, I mean, it's quite something, and you get these same, you know, kinds of comments, only now instead of it being sort of you know, maybe unfortunately uneducated caller on a extremist talk show program, now it's, you know, a well-known writer of an editorial column expressing the views that was so long ago. My family didn't, right? These kinds of things. You know, actually, it wasn't very long ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in our lifetimes, you know, we have lived at the same time by those who were enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it can't then have been so long ago. And certainly, people's, you know, great grandparents or great great grandparents. One of the, you know, points that I emphasize in my classes is that we don't only inherit advantages from our ancestors, but we can also inherit disadvantages. And so if your great-grandparents were not allowed by law to own property, that's going to have an effect on your wealth, right? And if the wages that were paid to your ancestors were systematically and legally considerably lower or no wages at all, then again, the amount of money that they will have been able to have saved will be much less. And we know now that even a what sounds to us today like a small amount of wealth, let's say, you know, between $3,000 and $6,000, can make the difference of getting a community college degree, making a down payment on a modest home, starting a small business, things that can make a huge difference in one's life and the lives of our kids and our grandchildren. So, you know, and for a long time in economics, the focus was on racial wage disparities and employment and unemployment disparities, which, of course, are real and important. But a lot of very good work has been done since the late 90s on racial wealth disparities. And, I mean, well, this is not feel-good, you know, news, but we have to know in order so that we can address these things, and they can be addressed.
Okay. We can quantify reparations, is what you're saying.
Oh,
quantify.
Absolutely. It's all, this is all stuff that even economists who don't, you know, hold any wild views, you know, can even contribute to this kind of stuff, because it's, you know, this is your field. This is basic accounting. So you take, you know, you can calculate net financial assets as assets minus debt. And net financial assets in the African American community as a whole are just, I mean, it's almost zero, but it's a little tiny bit positive. But, I mean, you know, compared to, for, you know, of course, these are averages, but still, it tells you something. You have to, you know, also look, there's a great inequality, you know, also among whites, but, you know, I try to explain to the students because it would be a simpler world if we could say that all the good guys line up on one side and then all the, you know, all the oppressors are on one side and all the oppressed are on the other side, but identity is complex. One may be the victim of one type of an oppression, but be privileged in another way. And so we've seen that racism and gender discrimination in unions and in apprenticeship programs and things like that, and gender discrimination or homophobia in you know, nationalist groups, or racism and classism in feminist groups, and so you have all these complicated issues, and you know, the traditional leftist position on race and class, you know, was that, well, white workers are hurt by discrimination against African Americans because it's kind of like capitalists and management employs a divide and conquer strategy to divide the working class along racial lines or gender lines, and then white workers or male workers also receive lower wages, this argument goes, because if there was a united working class, then the bargaining power would be stronger and everyone's wages, well, unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because if white workers, if male workers don't have a goal of revolution, throwing over capital and so on, but just protecting their relatively privileged position within the working class. And, you know, I asked the students to do a thought experiment. Okay, we know the black unemployment rate is always double the white rate, good times or bad economic times. And we know that the wage disparity and so on and so forth. So if overnight tonight there was, and we woke up in the morning, unemployment rates and wage rates were completely equal along race and gender lines, what would white men see when they woke up? Well, you know,
revolution.
Well, they would see that their unemployment rates have gone up and their wage rates have gone down. So, I mean, you know, and that when you turn to history from the economics, what you see is that unions and other institutions were used as means of excluding African Americans from access to those institutions which were a key part of the assimilation and Americanization process. And, you know, there's this famous book with the interesting title, how the Irish became white.
Yes.
And, you know, almost every European immigrant group from Southern Europe or Eastern Europe, but even the Irish, you know, were not considered white by whites when they first came to the U.S., but as a result of this assimilation and Americanization process, and key to those processes was union membership and jobs, you know. But obviously, you know, well, first of all, African Americans weren't an immigrant group, and
not by choice anyway,
right? And you know, weren't there, you know, don't hold your breath for the How African Americans Became White book to come out. Right?
That would be interesting.
You know? Well, and it's all the, you get all this chronological thing, but, you know, of course, African Americans preceded just about everybody, including whites, you know, in the United States. And so, you know, you have this, and then in the history, and I really highly recommend to your listeners Herbert Hill, the labor historian. But again, you know, a lot of people get very uncomfortable because the people who are expressing these racist views, where you see the letters and you see the material that was included even in, you know, you had the cigar makers union, and they had a piece of paper when you opened up the box of cigars, a piece of paper said, these cigars were not produced by coolie labor.
My goodness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, this is not 200 years ago, right? This is in the 1920s or so. The leaders, these are the heroes of the traditional left. These are the labor leaders like Samuel Gompers and people who you would read about, and even people who express some kind of, you know, socialist, democratic socialist type views. But you know, socialism for who, right?
I think you want to take a call. I think we got somebody on the line, Matt.
Of course.
All righty, caller, are you there?
Yeah, I've been totally fascinated by Dr. Matt. This is Brother Ron McMillan.
Brother Ron, how you doing?
How you doing, Ron?
An old time, we used to have you, my first doctor of sustainability.
Okay.
And missing conversations with you and some of the people over there at UMKC. But what I wanted to really put on you is the billionaire problem that we have in culture right now, whereas our problem is millionaires and billionaires.
Right.
We have so many of them, and we now see through computer data and everything where all the money went to in the last 20 years. And why we have so many of them, but they now actually count. It ain't just the Koch brothers, it's the Soros, it's the Bloombergs, it's the Donald Trumps, it's the men with too much money. And it's not just back when we used to talk. We used to talk about the racism of everything. But it ain't black-white no more. It's more class, oligarchy. A few with enormous amounts of money and power seem to have hijacked our system. And they call the shots on every... we were just down in Jeff City. Those people don't care about us. They don't care about ordinary citizens. They're locked into... is it classism? Is it, it's crazy politics. And when it comes to the history we have here, I can see why we would never get reparations. Most of the racist laws that were put against African Americans were done by Democrats. So we might have switched parties, or, you know, Lincoln came along and things switched, but the original laws that were all against blacks were made by all Democrats. They were the first party. It wasn't until Lincoln came along.
Right.
So you just can't blame one side or the other.
True.
Things have transferred, but billionaires and millionaires, what do we, how do we sustain that, Dr. Mann, in this struggle where they really are an oligarchy and they really are flexing their muscles?
Yes.
Thank
absolutely.
You, Brother Ron.
Yes.
All right. I'll listen.
Right. Yes. And
talk to you again.
Indeed. Thank you for calling.
And of course, you know, Ron is a fantastic, committed community activist, has, you know, done so much good work in Kansas City. Well, I think, you know, one of the issues is this intersection of political power and financial wealth.
Now, is that how you define oligarchy? Is oligarchy the term you would use?
That might be a very good way of yes, I think that would be a good way, an oligarchy. So yeah, it's a, you know, okay, we don't have a monarchy, but it is almost like that kind of a system where it's a consolidation of financial wealth and political power. And because of the way that the campaign contributions and the funding of the candidates, I mean, how could things ever change without that system and process being changed? Now, changing that alone is not going to be enough, but it is a necessary part of making any real change because, I mean, look at how many people felt so hopeful and enthusiastic about President Obama's first campaign. People who had not been involved, who had become discouraged, their hope was reignited. And of course, I mean, I don't want to make like there was, it was a major symbolic achievement, to have an African American president in the White House and so on and so forth. And, but it is almost as if you cannot, even if you wanted to even you were absolutely 100% you want to, you know, do some things, right? The way that the system is structured makes it almost impossible. So the way that the there has got to be, and again, there are many reasonable proposals out there how it could be done differently. We don't have to have all this money getting poured into what basically turns out to be buying candidates and buying legislation, the lobbying, the power of these political action committees, these PACs, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. So, I mean, that is one part of it is, I mean, you know, it sounds like a refrain. Everybody says over and over again, campaign finance reform, but it hasn't happened. So it's going to have to be, continue to be, you know, hammered away at so that the super wealthy, you know, the 1%, it's the 0.1%, you know.
How many people in real numbers is that?
Well, that's one, my only one thing about what Ron was saying. I mean, he's saying all these millionaires and billionaires, well, there can't be that many. I mean, you know, so.
A couple of hundred or?
Well, I mean, you have to, but, I mean, look, when you have, you know, 7 billion people on the planet, you know, I think they call it the law of large numbers. You know, a very small percentage of a very large number is a very large number. So, I mean, it you know, but you would think that as long as each person gets one vote, that, right, there's a limit to the amount of power that billionaires, but no, it doesn't work like that. I mean, you know, it would be really interesting to maybe have a series of occasional, you know, because I used to come in on a regular basis. I'm in town, and
yes,
we could have some of the people who bring in complementary, you know, areas of expertise.
I'd love
and
that.
We could start, you know, taking on some of these issues one by one, because, you know, one of the things that we did find out after the Great Recession and the Occupy movement and so on and so forth, is that actually there are many people who are open to alternative ideas and alternative ways of moving forward. And I mean, this is actually something that happens when there is a crisis.
Okay.
You know, it makes people more ready to consider some alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we are not, you know, out of that moment yet. We still have the opportunity because, look, not only hasn't, you know, the unemployment rate recovered,
mm-hmm,
but they really did not reform the financial system that caused the crisis. It's unbelievable.
It is. They've now they're doing rental the way they did housing. We're going to have to wrap it up and let MC get
mm-hmm
in here. But
sure, of course.
Promise to come back soon, Matt, and we're going to work on
be
this.
Be my pleasure.
We're going to work on this
yes
series of
yes
sessions on economics.
Great.
And shining the
love
light
to
on what's going on.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks for
today
having me. It's so much pleasure.
Matt Forstatter, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City Department of Economics. And please stay tuned, everybody, for guess who's coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.